From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The COVID-19 pandemic has unleashed an unemployment epidemic in the United States. Just listen to On Point listener Kim in New Hampshire.
I am experiencing unemployment as an LNA, licensed nurse assistant. So when I went to apply for a job with a home care agency for when this virus and quarantine is lifted, my landlord let me know that if I do go to work in that kind of place, it's called Visiting Angels, I can't live here anymore. So I'm now faced with unemployment plus lack of housing, and I'm not sure what to do.
Well, Sasha from Ithaca, New York, told us that she's been trying to apply for unemployment assistance since she lost her job 3 weeks ago.
I have not been able to get through on the phone or online. I'm having an issue filing a claim online. So that's 3 weeks that I've been without pay and not able to file. And yeah, I'm getting pretty desperate at this point. My husband works in healthcare and he's been having to go to work. And now that we're hearing about more and more younger people dying and sick from it, it makes me very scared.
And this is what William is facing in Opelousas, Louisiana.
This is going on the fourth week now that I've lost wages. I am homeless. And it's just a horrible situation. And I am running out of options. I'm running out of food. And we really need some help out here on the streets. Where's the help from the government? I need help bad.
Washington has passed historic aid packages, but with at least 10 million Americans filing for unemployment in March alone, this hour we must ask, did it have to be this way? What is it about the U.S. economy and how it works, about its policies, that unleashed an unemployment epidemic while trying to fight the COVID-19 pandemic? And how can we bend this particular curve too, this joblessness curve? So to address those questions today, we're joined by Cecilia Rouse. She is Dean of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. She's also a professor of economics and served as a member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors from 2009 to 2011. Dean Rouse, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
And also with us is Betsy Stevenson. She's a professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan. She's a faculty research associate at the National Bureau of Economics and served as the chief economist of the United States Department of Labor from 2010 to 2011. Professor Stevenson, welcome to you.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, so I feel, honestly, I feel incredibly fortunate now for my health and job at the moment. But let me begin by first asking both of you, was this convulsion of unemployment, this historic unemployment, inevitable in terms of the consequences of fighting COVID-19? Dean Rouse, let me start with you. Was it inevitable?
Well, I think that depends on how we want to think of inevitable. I am not a medical expert, but from all that I have read, if we had been better prepared in terms of our testing, we could have been much more strategic in terms of understanding who was positive for COVID, so we could then do contact tracing and therefore being much more strategic. But in the absence of having the vaccine for COVID-19 or having really effective quick treatment for it, I think it was inevitable with a disease that is so contagious that there was going to have to be some pause on our activity. And so I think some level of economic standing down, if you will, was going to be necessary. What I think is likely unnecessary is if we'd had the testing in place, it wouldn't have needed to be on such the massive, rather blunt scale that it is. But since we're flying blind, we need everybody to, in a sense, stand down. We need to put ourselves into an economic coma so that we can let the virus pass and get to the other side.
Professor Stevenson, your answer to that same question, inevitability?
So
I mean, I share a lot of what Cece was just saying, and let me put a little bit of numbers on that. So I was in Australia in January watching this unfold in China. And the thing about Australia is they have really deep connections with China. The university I was at, University of Sydney, 20% of their students are from mainland China. And yet, if you take a look at what's happened in Australia, they have so far 48 deaths. They have done 2.5 times as much testing per million people as the United States has done. They're using widespread testing, and they're using really significant tracing. So if somebody's found to be positive, they figure out who they've been in contact with, and then they test those people. So there are other ways to have managed this disease. Now, I should say Australia is also experiencing shutdowns and experiencing the same kind of financial hardship. So there you have an example where we see the disease has been somewhat better managed, and yet there's still a cease in economic activity. So I think that that says, yes, some reduction in economic activity was absolutely going to be necessary given the worldwide pandemic we're facing. There's a question about whether we could have done this better, but I think in some sense, why answer that question right now? The question I'm focused on is how do we address the public health crisis while minimizing the damage to the economy right now and find a way to get people back to work, get people financially supported over the next 6 months to a year while simultaneously managing the public health crisis.
Mm.
So I think it's time to be forward-looking, and there will be a time to be backward-looking.
Okay, a point taken. But getting people back to work, there's a lot just within that one statement here. So let's just dig into it a little. I've seen some predictions, say, from the St. Louis Fed that say we could see unemployment perhaps in a worst case scenario at 30%, which would put it higher than it was during the Great Depression in the 1930s. And I think the reason why what's at the heart of this right now is that this economic pause, to put it lightly, is not because of some kind of market failure, right? This is not a market-induced recession. I think it's really important to state that clearly. The economy was humming along. I mean, we've gone from a 50-year low in unemployment to the highest job losses on record, and all because of this government-induced pause to control a deadly pandemic. But what I wonder is, in terms of the job losses, and this isn't just like a pause from work. These are people who are out of work. They are no longer employed. It's a particular kind of economic pain that we're seeing in the United States that we aren't actually seeing in some other countries that are also fighting this pandemic. They're taking a GDP hit, but their jobs are being preserved. So Dean Rouse, why is that? Why are we seeing this particular form of economic pain in the U.S.?
Well, some of this, and I'm not trying to be flip, but some of it has to do with how we are conceptualizing of the workers who are not at work. And one of the issues we've got in the U.S. is because of the way that we've structured the aid package, where we did do it through our unemployment system, is we have workers who are not at work, and what they do not know is whether there is a job to which they will come back. So in the countries such as in France and Germany, and I believe Denmark, and I'm sure there are others, where they have structured the aid to workers through the employers, so that the workers are having their wages subsidized, as long as the employers are paying their wages, are being subsidized by the government, they still conceive of themselves as being employed. Our workers may return to a job if the job remains, but they were separated in a sense. One of the questions that will come out actually when the employment numbers come out in early May is how do workers actually respond to the current population survey questions about why they're not at work. Do they see themselves as being somebody who's going back to a job? So are they, in a sense, on layoff or furlough? Mm-hmm. Or do they see themselves as having been fired and therefore they are, in a sense, looking for a new job and don't expect to go back? We actually don't know the answer to that question so well, And so some of this is semantics. What we know is that workers are without a paycheck. And the way that I think the scary part about our aid package, which I do think had many of the right components, is that since we did it through our rather weak, if you will, safety net system, so unemployment insurance was never designed to be a safety net in this way. It was designed to help workers who've been separated from a job through no fault of their own to help them find a new job that was suitable. It was not designed as an immediate safety net. Mm-hmm. And that's why you see workers in particular who are without a paycheck. In normal times, it can take 2 to 3 weeks after filing before you get your first unemployment check. In this pandemic, those 2 to 3 weeks are, you know, that's a lifetime. I can't believe what I was doing 2 to 3 weeks ago. It feels like that was 200 years ago. But these workers, especially since they have the uncertainty, there are not other jobs to look for because we've asked the economy to cease and desist. Yeah. So there aren't other jobs to be looking for. They've got an immense amount of uncertainty. And I think that's where a lot of the challenge is fundamentally it's our rather leaky safety net in the way that we've structured
that. And I want to explore that more in a moment. Professor Stevenson, we've just got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break. So let me just get your first quick thought on the, you know, unemployment insurance was the system we had in place. Was it the best system to funnel money to workers now?
What we wanted to do is get people money in the quickest way possible. And so using our existing infrastructure is an important way to do that. People are already saying that the unemployment checks aren't coming fast enough. Imagine if we were trying to set up an entirely new system, funneling money to it. You can say, let's just have businesses pay everybody, but many businesses only have 15 days worth of cash on hand. They don't have the money to pay people unless the government's getting them the money. So we needed to do what was quick. And if you looked at the employment report we got for March, the rise in unemployment was all due to temporary layoffs. Mm.
Well, so Betsy Stevenson and Cecilia Rouse, hang on for a second. We are talking about the epidemic of unemployment in the United States right now and what to do about it. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the record levels of unemployment in the United States, or the record numbers of Americans who have filed for unemployment in just the past couple of weeks and what to do about it. I'm joined today by Cecilia Rouse. She's dean of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, and she joins us from Princeton, New Jersey. And also with us is Betsy Stevenson. She's professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan, with us via Skype today from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And let's listen to a little bit more of the wave of voicemails that we got from On Point listeners when we asked about the struggles they're facing being suddenly unemployed. This is Samantha. She called us from Florida. Both she and her husband have been out of work for about 2 weeks.
I am almost 5 months pregnant, and our household has lost its entire income, which is definitely unnerving. They have the unemployment and also the stimulus coming out. However, you don't know when that will actually reach you. So unnerving is extremely appropriate.
And this is George from New Orleans. He does freelance film and radio work. And here's how he described what it was like or is like applying for unemployment in Louisiana.
Trying to apply for unemployment through the Louisiana website feels like Kafka meets Homer Simpson. It doesn't really, hasn't been adjusted to understand how to work with independent contractors. My understanding is that the federal government has yet to give guidelines, so the CARE Act doesn't really mean anything until they do that.
That's George from New Orleans. Dean Rouse, let's just dig into what George said a little bit, because, again, we're talking about that the government opted to use the infrastructure we had in place as quickly as possible to get a first sort of wave of assistance to newly unemployed Americans. But we're seeing a big difference in state to state in terms of how workers have been able to access those benefits. I mean, that's a problem already.
Well, the way that our unemployment insurance system works is that it is basically a state-level system. It's technically a federal-state partnership, but each state sets up its own system according to federal guidelines. And so there is variation across states in how one goes about applying for benefits, in terms of how much funding the states have available absent the federal government's assistance. And so there is going to be variation. Some of it reflects the preferences of the value of the voters in the state, or at least the state infrastructure, about how hard it is to apply for unemployment insurance benefits. And so we do see that variation as part of the American way, which is we delegate many policies and actions to the states. So I completely agree that we went to battle with the army we had, and the unemployment insurance system was the system we had set up. But it was not set up for the volume of claims. I think most states are completely overrun with, as you mentioned, 10 million people claiming. Typically, there might be 500,000 in a typical week. So this is a scale and with a speed that is rather unprecedented, which is rather unfortunate.
Well, so given that, I actually want to question the notion that using unemployment insurance as the infrastructure to get this historic aid out was the best and only option in the United States. Because as both of you have mentioned, for example, in Europe, Germany, Denmark, these are great examples, they used something that they already had in place as well, which was essentially, you know, a work subsidy or work sharing programs where people maintained their employment. Perhaps they're working less, fewer hours or no hours at all, but the government is paying essentially their wages through the employers. They're giving money to the employers to then keep the wages going to the employees, so people don't actually lose their jobs. Okay, so we've seen that work before after the 08 financial crisis. A version of that, if I remember correctly, was launched here in the United States, and we are seeing a smaller version of that for small businesses right now too. But the idea that we couldn't, I question the idea that we couldn't do this again at a larger scale, and here's why. Because I'm seeing here that in the UK, in the month of March, they essentially built a program like that, if not from scratch, from very little, right? And now they're promising workers 80% of their pay and to maintain their jobs. They pulled it off in a month in the UK. Why couldn't we, or maybe should we still attempt to pull something like that off here? Betsy Stevenson?
Well, first of all, let me just clarify that work sharing does exist in the United States, and an expansion of work sharing, including federal financing, was included in the CARES Act.
Yes.
This is a policy that Senator Jack Reed has been pushing for, I think, his entire career. And as you said, he got that up and running in the 2008 recession. The federal financing for it expired, but that was re-upped in the CARES Act. But that still goes through our unemployment insurance system. So we're, you know, we do what happens there is an employer applies to be part of that program, and then the money is still coming through the unemployment insurance system. So I, you know, the U.S. system, we do not have the kind of government involvement in the labor market that a country like Germany has, or even really that like a country like the U.K. has. So I am not convinced that the U.S. Could move that smoothly to getting payments to a range of companies, particularly the ones that would find it most important to get money in hand before they could continue their payroll. You know, I'm just not convinced that they could necessarily do that quickly. I think the real question here, there's sort of two questions you raised. Mm-hmm. One is, would it be faster if we did it through some other system? And then the second one is, would it do a better job of maintaining worker business employer relationships if we did it by having employers continue to pay people. And I don't think that the answer to either of those questions is particularly clear. I think that policymakers on both sides of the aisle felt like it would be faster to use the existing infrastructure. In terms of whether we are maintaining relationships between employers and employees, I think that's essentially going to come down to ensuring that we don't have a bunch of employers liquidating. So we need to make sure that employers are able to stay in business because, you know, even if you're paying them to keep people on payroll, if they've gone bankrupt, that's not going to help. What we need to be doing is making sure that big parts of the economy are not destroyed through this process. And that's what's going to allow things to open up faster.
Dean Rouse, what do you think about that? I hear Professor Stevenson's analysis here, but also, look, I can't help it. I can't help but to question, wait, why couldn't we do it in the United States? I mean, look, we hear all the time about American innovation and American capacity and American greatness, for that example. Well, why couldn't we come up with a program, craft a program quickly and efficiently to bring about some kind of effective work subsidy plan in the United States? What's stopping us?
Well, I think what Betsy's referring to is the fact that if there's not authorizing language, then we do require Congress to get together and very quickly come up with that language and build the infrastructure, presumably within the Treasury Department, to actually execute. So that is, I'm not as far as Betsy is, but I'm not in Washington, D.C. From my perch, I think it was amazing that they put together the package that they did so mm-hmm. quickly. But what this other program would have required is another step, which was conceiving of what that program was, getting it authorized in addition to getting it funded. I would like to go back to what Betsy also pointed out, which is the other half of workers having a job is that there are jobs to go back to.
Yes.
And I have been corresponding with a friend of mine who runs a small business here in Princeton, and she's struggling. So she doesn't quite seem to qualify for the unemployment benefits herself as a business owner because she has more than 20% ownership in her business. And then there are some people who are small business owners who are getting denied the unemployment insurance. And yet the way that the relief to through the banks, which is coming, so for her business where they have the forgivable loans, is choosing to do that through the private bank has meant that the banks don't fully know what the guidance is and they're waiting for that relief too. And so she's pretty anxious that she won't have the liquidity that she'll need in order to stay afloat to get through this crisis and to reopen. So that's the other half of it. I don't know what options Treasury might have had for directly lending to the small businesses rather than going through the private banks, which I think is adding a complication. But that's the other side of the scissors, if you will, which is that these businesses do need to stay afloat.
So, Professor Stevenson, can you tell us more about that? I mean, it sounds as if the concern about businesses liquidating could be widespread.
I think that there is enormous concern about that. My understanding is the decision to go through the banks was because it would be quicker. I think that in hindsight we may learn that was a mistake. But as Cece said, you would need, Congress would need authorization to give authorization to Treasury, but Treasury would also need the workforce ready to do direct lending to businesses. There was a lot of concern at the beginning that the Small Business Association would never be able to handle the volume of borrowing that was necessary. But we're seeing that they're struggling just to get the guidance out to banks. Mm-hmm. And so what I would I interpret that as if they're struggling just to get the guidance out, imagine if they were actually trying to get the dollars out the door.
So how do we fix that? I mean, what do we do? Professor Stevens, that is not a deliberately ignorant question. You're raising a fundamental issue here. Do we even have the beginnings of an answer of what we do if there are basic challenges in even getting the money out the door? How would we fix that?
I want to second what Cece said, which is, I mean, we saw Congress move incredibly quickly on this, way quicker than we saw them move in 2008. So that's on the plus side. The problem is that we have never seen an economy really fall off a cliff this quickly. And so people are desperate for the money today. I think that, pessimism in the system, I've been blown away that the unemployment insurance system was able to take in 10 million claims over a 2-week period when they're used to taking in 400,000 claims over a 2-week period. Just, that volume alone is impressive. I think we have to march forward with the plan we have. It's why I guess I'm not enthusiastically saying let's switch gears and try some other way to get money to businesses. We have a plan. They're marching forward. The banks have every incentive to give this money out. And I am hoping that they're getting clarity by the minute in terms of what they need to do to get the money out. We should be trying to, I think when we're thinking about the next wave of support, which the federal government is going to have to do another wave of support, direct payments were important for a reason. They are the absolute easiest thing to get out the door. I think we'll need another round of direct payments.
So what I'm about to say is has nothing to do with the both of you and your analysis, but it has everything to do with why I feel there is a legitimate surge of pessimism amongst American workers right now. That 10 million number, first of all, to begin with, a little tiny sample of that equated to the largest number of phone calls we've ever received on this program about any single subject. People are pessimistic because up until a month ago, for many of them, their lives were going just fine. I mean, the economy was working here, granted, in different ways for different people at different levels. And then all of a sudden, like that, all taken away for 10 million people, including for many of them, their health care, their housing security. We heard from William at the top of the hour. He's living in a tent right now. So I think that it's completely legitimate for Americans to say, hang on, we should have seen this coming. We knew from November and December, even January, that something major was going to have to be done to stop this pandemic or slow it down. So if there's pessimism and frustration right now, it's because it's a kind of tough pill to swallow to hear that, like, well, we're just even having trouble getting money out the door. Do you see what I'm saying, Dean Rouse? So I'm just trying to say that I think that people are right to say we need the government, we need our policymakers to step up right now and do the best they can as quickly as they can to mitigate the damage being done, the harm being done to lives because of what we needed to do to slow this pandemic down.
Well, I agree with that. I think that we have the private market is very important, but I think this pandemic really illustrates when there is a need and a role for government. And we've got the classic market failures in the sense of we've got these massive negative externalities with a pandemic, with an infectious disease, and we need coordination across the states, across localities. So I think that that's exactly right. I think that there's a very important role for the federal government. I think there's a very important role for state and local government as well. And I think we should be demanding that they step up. But that said, it's hard for even the federal government and the state and local governments, and they're doing their best. I don't know if everybody's doing their best, but everybody is trying and everybody's starting to appreciate the magnitude of the pandemic. everybody has a role to play, but it's so fast. It's, we can't just wave a magic wand and have even what we're attempting to do work perfectly. Mm. I completely agree that there's going to be a very likely need another wave of aid. I like the structure of the aid that of this, I guess it was technically the third phase. I think one aspect that we've got to keep our eye on are the state governments and the state aid, because they are hemorrhaging and many of them are going to be required to balance their budgets. But I think we have to be patient, and we're all in, remember that we're all in this together.
Right. And so when we come back, we'll talk about in more detail what maybe some good next steps could be. So Dean Rouse and Professor Stevenson, hang on here. And by the way, just to note, like, there are ideas percolating in Washington. For example, the Preventing Layoffs During a Public Health Emergency Act, which is being proposed by Representatives Rosa DeLauria and Mark Pocan. We'll see if that goes anywhere. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the epidemic of unemployment unleashed by the coronavirus, or the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm joined today by Cecilia Rouse. She's Dean of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. She's a professor of economics and served as a member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors from 2009 to 2011. I'm also joined by Betsy Stevenson. She's a professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan, and she served as the chief economist on the U.S. Department of Labor, at the U.S. Department of Labor, I should say, from 2010 to 2011. Now, we spoke with Senator Sherrod Brown, Ohio Democrat, yesterday, because he's made the dignity of work a focus of his time in Congress. And we asked Senator Brown if he thinks Congress will expand programs that allow businesses to keep employees on their payrolls.
I think the goal of what Congress should be doing is that we want to make sure that when the pandemic isn't actually in the rearview mirror, that our economy can scale up and can launch in the best way for the most people. And that means keeping businesses intact whenever possible. It means, most importantly, keeping money as close to what people's pay was, within some range, of course, what people's pay was prior to the pandemic. So those employees are ready to go to expand or grow or just bring back to what it was on these businesses.
Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, we spoke with him yesterday. Now, Professor Stevenson, there's something that the senator said there about keeping businesses intact whenever possible. I want to circle back to something you said earlier about the concern about businesses just liquidating because they can't keep their heads above water. I wonder, you know, after 08, one of the deep wells of criticism that came particularly from the left was, you know, corporations shouldn't have been bailed out. Certain banks or members of the financial sector shouldn't have been bailed out because it was their malfeasance to begin with that brought about that disaster. I mean, I think we can safely say, as I mentioned at the top of the show, that is not the case this time around. We're not looking at market failures here. We're not looking at bad behavior from businesses here as the primary cause. So, I mean, should corporate bailouts, in order to help preserve jobs, to help preserve businesses, also be a continued focus of Congress?
So I'm glad you circled back to that, because I just want to be clear here that there is a big, important market failure. That market failure is called externalities. Mm-hmm. It's when my behavior impacts your behavior, but the market's not taking that into account. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, what we're essentially seeing with this pandemic is something that's very similar to climate change. It's just right now we're in an immediate life or death event, whereas climate change is a longer run one. The same problem is pervasive, which is that, you know, our behaviors are impacting other people. And if we were just left to do, you know, go about and do what was in our own individual incentive, we could end up with an enormous amount of deaths. And that's why we need government leadership to do things like have a coordinated staying at home. What we're learning is that in a market economy where market failures through externalities are pervasive, it is useful to have a robust safety net.
Right.
And we have not had a robust safety net. That's been a choice that the United States has made. And that choice is really hitting us quite hard right now. Now, you brought up the fact, though, that there may be a market failure here, but it's not the fault of a particular set of players in the market, meaning the business side. So this is not like businesses have been doing something wrong, and if we help them out, we create a set of bad incentives that will encourage them to do something wrong again in the future. Everyone here is potentially getting hurt, employers and workers. We're all in this together, and it's not going to help workers if we let the corporations, whether they're big business or small business, go belly up, because then there won't be any jobs to come back to. Mm-hmm. We saw as part of the CARES Act that, you know, there was a large amount of money that was in it in order to support the Federal Reserve Board's lending facilities. That looks a lot like what we had in 2008, TARP. And what we saw in TARP, despite all the criticisms from people, was that businesses mostly paid that money back. At the end of the day, that wasn't what cost the taxpayers very much money. And my guess is of the $2.2 trillion spent in the CARES Act, the $500 million that goes to support that corporate lending will ultimately get most of that back. So that's the right decision, is to make sure that we are supporting liquidity in the economy. But I think the economists and people debate more about, should business owners, should we be protecting them and their income as much as we're protecting the income of everyday folks? And Cece gave you an example of a small business owner who herself is struggling. I know a lot of small business owners like that. But there are people on that other side of the equation. Their revenue has gone to zero, or has fallen substantially. And yes, if we want to maintain the fabric of our economy so we can go back, we're going to have to support them.
So I truly appreciate I think the big takeaway that you just offered us, because I'm trying to, you know, as we on the staff, like, I feel like our new mission has become to have every On Point ask questions about, like, what is the mirror that this moment is raising up to us as a nation? What are we seeing about ourselves as a country more clearly than we have ever seen before or should have seen before? And this is one of them, Professor Stevenson. I think you're saying that, like, we have a market economy or an American style of capitalism that even in its strongest moments, because of the lack of a robust social safety net, is not all that resilient for the effects of these massive externalities. So Dean Rouse, I mean, maybe after we get past this first stage of economic triage, do you see this as an opening to perhaps somehow meaningfully strengthen that safety net?
Well, I certainly hope so, because I, for one, believe that there is a role for government in particularly these times. And one aspect that I've been concerned about is that our safety net is so tied to employment.
Exactly.
So, for example, I really think if we come out of this and we understand what the value of the Affordable Care Act was in trying to provide health insurance for those who cannot get it through their employer, I hope that we can strengthen the Affordable Care Act. rather than retreat from that. Paid sick leave is another example. It would have been it's been very important, and many places have stepped up in trying to provide this, but it's very important for workers who are sick to stay home and to not share their sickness with their coworkers. And then if we just talk about the part of the safety net for those who are without employment at all, which has really gotten whittled down to food security programs and very little else, I think as a result, workers' compensation and disability has sort of de facto started to play that role of helping workers who just have given up and are without work entirely, even though many of them possibly could be working in the right circumstances. I do hope we look back at this and say, we need to have a stronger safety net. Not only do we understand that there are going to be situations that will befall all of us, even those who are working, and also those who may not be without a job. As our economy may start to move towards more of the gig economy, more contract work, more shorter term relationships between workers and employers, I think it's going to be very important that we have a way for workers to get the health insurance, the retirement benefits, and the other kinds of benefits you see in other countries and not have to rely so entirely on our employment system for that.
Professor Stevenson, I recall that after 2008, one of the sort of long-term hidden pains was, even as the job market ostensibly recovered, we had a lot of people just permanently dropping out of the labor market. Do you worry that if it takes a while for the U.S. economy to recover from this, that we might see that again?
So we saw really enormous destruction in the last recession, destruction of workplaces with businesses closing shop, and destruction of skills as workers lost jobs in industries that they could no longer find employment in. And all of that destruction is what makes it hard to recover. People have to, train for new skills if they're changing industries. They have to search for new employers. New businesses have to begin the somewhat long process of, starting up. The hope is there's going to be less permanent destruction in this recession. But ultimately, the answer will be, how do we handle the public health crisis? So Cece was just talking about how people don't really have paid sick days. Not enough workers have access to paid sick days. Yet the research shows clearly that people are less likely to come to work with contagious diseases if they have paid sick days.
Right.
We are going to have to open up the economy when coronavirus is still with us. We may have a treatment that makes it a bit less deadly, but my guess is, and also it will probably be less prevalent because more people will have been exposed to it. They'll have slowed down the contagion rate. But the reality is that it will be in our society, it will be contagious, and it will still be possible to die from it, and we will be going to work. And we really want people to stay home when they have coronavirus. So we have to think as we open the economy about how we are going to give people access to the benefits they need. How are we going to address the ongoing public health problem while getting people back to work? That's going to be the answer to your question. Can we manage that in a way that we minimize the destruction of people's skills, the destruction of their relationships with their employers, and the destruction of our workplaces? The more we can minimize that, the easier it's going to be to go back. The more destruction there is, the more likely it is we create a group of people who become long-term unemployed.
Right. I personally do believe there's a lot to be learned from comparative analyses. So I keep going back to the different approaches we've been seeing, for example, in some European countries versus the United States. Look, the U.S. approach, in my mind, actually introduces a lot of friction into the labor market because people will have to apply for work. This is after trying to apply for their unemployment benefits. They'll have to find those new jobs. They'll have to get retrained. All of those things come at a cost. It makes the economy less efficient, in my view. But, we also talked to Ricardo Haish at the London School of Economics, and he told us, us that while European countries have that well-developed or better-developed social safety net that we were talking about, he says, and the United States lacks administrative capacity to deploy something like that quickly right now. He also said that there might be a trade-off, and here's what he said.
But the other side of that coin is that in a few months, we hope, maybe even a few weeks, but certainly let's hope definitely not a few years, when we go back to normal, this is where the American economy, with its flexibility, with its great business dynamism, rhythm of job creation, this is when the Europeans start saying, boy, we wish we were like the Americans. Look how quickly they generated jobs. New firms showed up. People left unemployment and went back to work. And look how slow and rigid things are here in Europe.
Dean Rouse, do you think that's a possibility? We could bounce back faster?
I think that's absolutely a possibility. That is part of the strength of the U.S. labor market. I do worry, however, that because of those labor market frictions that you mentioned, which is that workers don't necessarily identify themselves as working for a particular employer, and so they decide they're going to look for additional work, or maybe we've lost a large number of small businesses. They may rebuild, but that will take some time for them to rebuild. That while we may ultimately, ultimately prove more resilient than the European model, it may take us longer.
Mm. Well, I keep also coming back to all the voices of listeners that we've heard just in the past 24 hours and those truly shocking unemployment numbers. So to get us sort of refocused on the immediate present, Professor Stevenson, I mean, members of Congress and the president are already now talking again about more aid. So what would you advise? Like, where would you say they ought to put their efforts in these in a next package or a next step to help people who are in pain right now?
Well, first of all, I think people are in pain right now because they haven't got their hands on the payments. Every minute they have to wait is painful, but those payments are coming, and I think that's going to provide a lot of relief to people. I do think a next aid package is going to need to do another round of those direct payments to individuals. They just need to direct deposit money into people's accounts that they have, or mail people checks for people whose account information they don't have. If you've filed your 2019 taxes and put in your information to get direct deposit, they should be able to direct deposit those direct payments to you. That's the fastest way to get people money. I have advocated that they do more of that. If we all end up that 2020 doesn't end up that bad, they can actually end up taxing some of that back in our April 2021 tax payments. But getting money to people right now is really important. But there's something else we haven't mentioned that I think it's important to keep in mind. State and local governments are losing revenue like crazy. And if they don't support the state and local governments, what we're going to find is when it's time to send our kids back to the classroom, they're going to be laying off the teachers because they don't have the money to pay for it. And the federal government needs to make sure that doesn't happen.
Mm. Dean Rouse, we've got about 30 seconds. Do you have a quick headline on a next step that you would like to see government leaders take?
I completely agree with Betsy. I think I had mentioned that I think that a support for state and local governments who have to balance their budgets will be critical, and the direct payments. And I also think it's important that we continue to support our small businesses in particular.
Well, Cecilia Rouse is Dean of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Dean Rouse, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And Betsy Stevenson, Professor of Public Policy and Economics at the University of Michigan. Professor Stevenson, it was a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brett.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.